Welcome to Subtitles, where we spike the canon in music and movies. In each episode, we will offer up replacements for each title in the top 100 of a well-known, well-regarded ranking, and we'll walk away with a pair of subtitles, which we think deserve more acclaim, and to which attention must be paid. I'm Matt, and I'm replacing the top 100 entries on Spin Magazine's 2015 list of the top 300 albums, from 1985 until 2015, starting with number one and working down.
And I'm Tim. I'm replacing the entries on the 2007 AFI 100 Years, 100 Movies list, starting with number 100 and working up.
Here's how this works. The two of us have gone through each list, decided on a theme of the original entry, and have come up with a pair of potential replacement titles which share that theme. We'll talk about that original entry. Sometimes we'll regret that we have to get rid of it, and sometimes we'll rejoice in being able to drop it. This podcast is not just another dissection of an outmoded list. In part one of this episode, I have two new albums to talk through, and Tim will make the choice for the subtitles albums list. Then, in part two, Tim will have two new movies to discuss, and I will decide which of them deserves a place on the subtitles movies list. Sometimes I'll have seen the movies, sometimes Tim will have listened to the albums, but at the end of the day, what matters is how well we've sold the titles. And at the end of some of those days, one of us will want to bop the other for that choice. And once we finish this off, we'll do some fun activities with the new lists we've collaborated on, but before we can get there, we have to do this. Today's title to be replaced is Appetite for Destruction, Guns N' Roses' 1987 debut. How much do I need to explain Appetite for Destruction? I feel like everyone probably knows it.
Guns N' Roses.
Guns N' Roses?
I mean...
In this economy?
I mean, the thing... And here I took
you sure you did that.
I know I took you seriously when you were like, I hate that one. And I'm like, all right, I will remove that particular bit.
Well, now it's spite.
So do you want me to like start with, because I have never listened to this one before. Like I made a point of listening to this. Really? Yeah, I'd never actually gone through and listened to the whole thing. Like I, of course, knew, Sweet Child of Mine and Welcome to the Jungle, although I frequently tell people that the lyrics to Welcome to the Jungle are Welcome to the Jungle, it's a jungle in here, which is clearly not the actual lyrics. But
by people, do you mean your students?
Just like occasionally I'll like mumble it to myself and people ask me, what are you saying? And I'm like, the wrong lyrics to Welcome to the Jungle by Guns N' Roses.
Do you do it in the voice of Randy Newman?
No. So the thing about this that sort of struck me was just like, I don't know. There's this weird reputation that I think a lot of these 80s, 90s, like hair metal or heavy metal adjacent bands kind of have, where there's so much about the image and so little about the musicianship. And what struck me listening to this album, as well as the other album that I managed to squeeze in before recording here, was just like how clearly talented and how good these people are. And it's not just like, oh, I'm nostalgic for 1987, and thus I think Slash is a good guitarist. Like, no, Slash is a good guitarist. Like, he certainly knows exactly what he is doing. And like, it's very interesting to sort of come to them with, you know, a 2000s knowledge of this band, as opposed to like growing up with them in any serious way and just realizing how good they were. This is their debut album. I didn't know this.
I think maybe there's like something small before this that only tape collectors have at this point. But this is the debut full length, at least. Unless there's something hiding out there that I'm forgetting, which I'm not going to rule out entirely, but pretty sure this is the debut. And that's sort of the, like, right, that's part of the mythic quality of the band, that this thing came out basically perfectly formed first. And then from there, it's like unraveling in several directions. Did you not know Paradise City before?
I don't think I had heard it before this now.
Man.
I know. And that was my favorite track. I'm like, wow, I really enjoy this Paradise City song.
It's, Have you never been in a sports arena before?
Not often.
No, well, fair. Well, yeah, let's run down there. I don't have anything novel to say about Guns N' Roses in the way that I don't have anything novel to say about, like, I don't know, Nirvana when they came up. But, okay, after Paradise City, what was your favorite?
That is a good question.
I'm full of them.
I sort of liked My Michelle, like that back-to-back of Paradise City, My Michelle spoke to me, I think. I thought the first part of the album was maybe a little less interesting to me than the second part of the album. It's a little bit preachier on the top of it, and I didn't get into that quite as much. But I did sort of like everything from like Mr. Brownstone and Paradise City on. Like, that's sort of where this kicked to a new level for me.
I want to come back to that, but I also don't think anyone has ever described Guns N' Roses as preachy.
Here I am.
Entertain you. Why?
I don't know. It felt...
Or maybe how
just,
is the better
it
question.
It just felt sort of... I don't... It was so easy to hear every single word, which I guess is also sort of surprising. Like, that's one of the great... Another one of those great stereotypes that you can't understand any of these people, but like you can understand everything that they're saying, which I thought was kind of interesting. And I don't know, something about It's So Easy and Night Rain and Out to Get Me, I just didn't get on board with right away. I don't know. I didn't enjoy what they were doing lyrically all that much. And then once it started to matter less what they were doing lyrically, then I was more engaged with it.
Thoughts on Mr. Brownstone? It's the one you left out.
Oh, that's that was like my turning point on that one. Okay. I mean, again, I thought
so when they started talking about heroin
a little, I thought it, again, sort of repetitive about you know, you start with a little and then go for more, but as someone who has listened to Comfortably Numb enough times, I feel like this at least spoke to me in a register that I was familiar with.
I love Mr. Brownstone. There's just like what you were saying. They're obviously massively skilled, and not just at the hair metal version of metal that gets ascribed to them. Mildly fairly, but mostly unfairly, I think. But even in something like Mr. Brownstone, there's just a groove to that one. There's even kind of a funk to it, which makes sense because the rhythm section, all of the people in this band are differently trained. And the rhythm section in particular has like a lot of kind of that funk, that blues backing. That's sort of, they're not like, you know, Juilliard trained necessarily, but like that's sort of the scene they come up in, so to speak. Not so to speak, like that's the scene they come up in. Slash, I think his dad was, I'm going to get this raw, like a costume designer or something for Bowie. And he's born in England. And like, so he just kind of, he comes up with a different sense of, or different exposure to guitar than the rest of, you know, the musical parts of the band, which have a West Coast backing. And of course, Axl is Axl. Welcome to the Jungle, the video is basically Axl Rose becoming the frontman for Guns N' Roses. So like, they're all coming from different places, and it leads to like surprisingly nuanced music, even, I would say. But we'll get back to that because Tim seems to have researched Slash's upbringing.
Oh, it's not even the upbringing so much. I just didn't know his actual name, and now I understand very much why he goes by Slash.
I still don't.
You want to know?
I've avoided that information my entire life, but let's break my soul here.
His name is Saul Hudson.
Oh wait, no, I did know that back in the day. Yeah. I wonder where he got Slash from. Does it say that at all?
That's a good question.
I think that kind of the like the question I asked off the top, like, do I need to say anything about Guns N' Roses? Like, you don't actually worry about, like, who these dudes are, and that's kind of the point, I think. But Tim is looking deeply. I'll riff. I'm intrigued that the second half stands out more to you, I think, because I think that's even more so the moment that separates what's happening on Appetite for Destruction from what we typically understand as West Coast American metal of the, not metal, hair metal, of the late 80s. Because that back half is much more punk inspired, which is another reference point or style that they have in their bag too. And you can hear it a lot in that second half. And I always kind of forget it's there, because the front half is like the more popular one besides Sweet Child of Mine. And it's just kind of doing different stuff across those two parts of the album. But I think it speaks to, right, there, stylistically, this is a band rooted in punk in many ways. Spiritually, it's definitely a band rooted in punk in terms of their ferocity, in terms of their forcefulness. So I think that back half of the album, you know, speaks to how this is a band kind of coming from a different place and have this meteoric rise into a scene and come to define it for better and worse. And we'll talk about we'll talk about in a meta way the fallout. But Tim, you got any info?
Okay, so Slash comes from, of all people, Seymour Cassell, who is a character actor in several films that we know and love. We can talk.
So you're in your bag.
Yeah, I was
now.
About to say, I really did not expect that Seymour Cassell would be the guy who like gave Slash this nickname. Like, I had no idea that John Cassavetes was going to have this much to do with it. In any event, apparently Slash just comes from him being super busy all the time and just like always doing something and being in a hurry. And I don't know where Slash comes from, but I'll take it. I'm reading an article from Swindle magazine from, I don't even know how old this is, like 2007 or something. And this is just a very interesting origin story for someone who loves guitar and drugs and nothing else. As far as I can tell, he really just loves two things. The quote, what is the quote that I lost here? When he started getting famous, we went back to Hollywood and it's the same shit, living in a cheap apartment and doing drugs all the time, except this time I didn't want to go out because people would recognize me. Like, this is an almost ascetic version of a rock guitarist, someone who just loves guitar and heroin.
Well, I think it's right to the proportion of like anecdotal myth at this point, but and his style is just right. You see a facade of Slash and you know who it is immediately
with the hat.
Yeah, like with the hat and the hair. And I think part of that was he kind of wanted to hide on stage or like not have to look at anybody with the hair in particular. I don't know quite where the hat came from, but like it's iconic now. You can't get rid of it. Another dude, like maybe this is a decile, like who are the artists who can never cut their hair? Or like if they ever lose it, it's going to be traumatic for an entire fan base. It's like Slash and Claudio and I don't know who else fits it.
Brian May.
That's yeah. Good call. He does physics, though. He'll probably figure out some way to like either keep it there or fool us all. There's a fun list we can work on some other time. Anything you want to hear about Guns N' Roses, Tim, or Appetite for Destruction. It's the album with Welcome to the Jungle. It's the album with Sweet Child of Mine, which I think most people insist is way more happy than it is. And it's a sweet song to a point, but it ends in a fairly sustained minor key, which I think is significant because, again, this is a band that does know what they're doing, no matter how high they are. It's the album with Paradise City. Like, it's raucous, it's aggressive, it's ferocious, it is in equal parts hedonistic and cautionary. Sometimes it's cautionary by example, sometimes it's cautionary, as Tim was saying, I don't know if I go to the level of preachy, but like, right, actively trying to warn. And even in that quote you pulled out from Slash, you know, Axel has said similar. I think that, like, right, they became the bad boys of the scene and got put into that. And I think he says something to the effect of, that was just us, but also the image sells, so we weren't going to fight it, really. So there's an interesting degree in which, like, right, this is a band that cares about music and they care about drugs. And like, that's the band, and they're incredible at both of those things. And on Appetite for Destruction, it's right, it's like the entire mission statement first, but it's also the entire, like, this is the myth, this is the band, this is everything. And it came out right away in 1987, and everything else from there, as massively popular as they would be for several more years and still are, like, no one else taking 20 some years to release an album called Chinese Democracy would matter. I'm sure their reunion tours sold in gangbusters. Like, this is a band that's still massively famous and massively popular, but like, it kind of all happened on Appetite for Destruction. Like, this is the statement, this is kind of the pinnacle of an entire scene as well. I want to break that down a little bit more because that's going to get into our theme, but I don't know, anything in particular you want to talk about with Guns N' Roses or with Appetite?
So just looking at this article, which is basically just an interview with Slash, he's sort of mentioning his influences, which I think is potentially useful, even though I usually avoid influence discourse because it bores me. But this, the way he phrases it is kind of...
Don't you like T.S. Eliot?
I like it for things that are 100 years old, and any more recent than that, I'm not interested. But there's an interesting self-knowledge about the way that he's talking about his influences. He says, I grew up on the Stones, Bob Dylan, the Kinks, and Zeppelin. But when I discovered this one Aerosmith record, I related to it on a different level. Which I just think is like this really interesting statement about like what worked for him. And he's naming, again, like, you could do a lot worse than naming the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin. Is like, if you're going to aspire to be a great guitarist, you could do a heck of a lot worse than that. But it's interesting that Aerosmith is the one that gets him. And I am like translating this into film terms and thinking about, you've got Steven Spielberg, who grows up watching Howard Hawks and David Lean. And then you get a whole new generation of people who are influenced by Spielberg, but without like the Hawks or the Lean, which I think is kind of interesting. Is there a comparison there for Slash? Like, are there people who are like influenced by him, but maybe have lost some of the Aerosmith or the Zeppelin of it all in translation?
That's a good, the comp that comes to mind first, I don't know specifically about Slash, though I'm sure, just because he's such a theatrical guitarist, and I think that definitely had, I don't know about literally right this moment, but certainly I can think of times in the 2000s where like that has a lot of cachet. But I think what they're missing is sort of the, like, the blues in Slash, or the groove even, like, right. There's a different kind of foundation there. Like, it's theatrical playing, but it's not theatricality for the sake of it. Like, this is an incredible riff album, and Slash is able to create whatever mood is needed for any song, right? You get the terror of Welcome to the Jungle. You get the, you know, at least in the opening, the sweetness of Sweet Child of Mine. Like, his arpeggio on that is, right, understandably and deservingly a classic. He was also apparently just like noodling that as a warm-up exercise, and Axl decided that's the song. Like, right, that's like stuff just kind of falls out of this guy. Like, I think there's a bass there that maybe doesn't get picked up, but the explosiveness of it, the nimbleness of it really got picked up by, I imagine, a lot of people. The comp I think of first though is, right, my old friend Nu Metal. Particularly Korn, when they say something to the, this is part of their like, right, instantiated history now, but I think it was the bassist Monkey or Fieldy, one of them, Monkey or Fieldy, says, right, our history is Red Hot Chili Peppers and Faith No More and Jane's Addiction. Like, that's where we start. We don't listen to anything before that. Which is really provocative in ways that I think is fascinating and very endearing. But right, that does kind of, I don't think that's a bad base certainly, but like, right, there are a lot of people that influence the Chili Peppers and Faith No More and Jane's Addiction, and like, it's just sort of a cutting off of that history. So like, that's the comp of, I think, of first, which I think is analogous, but no, you can tell me if not, but I think, you know, with Slash in particular, I'm not sure, but I can, right, I just kind of guessing, I think that's probably happened, but I couldn't tell you like who specifically.
Well, no, it just, I didn't expect like specifics because that was extremely off the cuff, but it's just sort of interesting to me, and especially thinking about your theme for the week, which we should probably get to, but your idea about what ties your albums together for this episode just sort of interests me in terms of, well, if the Giants were roaming at some point, then like what's been lost in shrinking people to more normal proportions here. So that was just sort of on my mind a little bit.
Well, if I had been thinking more, I could have also taken that into the like, what are we making oil out of? Yeah, but I didn't quite get there, and I don't think I'm going to try. I don't think I'm going to try and improv that one. So
we don't need to find out who the peat bog is in 80s rock.
Yeah. So our theme today is When Dinosaurs Roamed, as Tim was beginning to allude to. I want to take dinosaur not just in the sense of old, like an old that we're just not going to get back, really. I don't think we're going to get this 80s metal moment back. As fun as I think it would be, I don't think it's coming back. But I also want to think about dinosaur in the sense of megafauna, really, as these massive, in the case of music, massive institutions that are particularly evolved and adept for their moment, but are also doomed. And of course, this is in hindsight. I'm not saying in 87, which, fun fact, all the albums today are from 1987. And I think that's something I did intentionally way back at the start and then forgot I had done, and was a happy surprise last night when they were all 1987 still. I don't think in the moment anyone was, certainly with two of them, were thinking, oh, this is all doomed. It's the meteor is going to come. But in hindsight, they're all kind of emblematic of moments that I just don't think we're getting back. But they were damn good for those moments. So thinking about it in a couple of ways, and also thinking about like what are the dinosaurs that they're drawing from. And this actually kind of goes to your point. This one is an improv. I made this kind of part of the theme. Like, in what influences perhaps are these bands drawing from that get elided when we think about them, maybe, or when people hear them on the radio. So thinking about it in a couple different directions, but I also have something fun I'm going to do that I think Tim will enjoy quite a lot, but we'll get to that in a second. Questions on the theme or anything I need to explain more or better?
So just when dinosaurs ruled the earth, the classic.
Yeah, pretty much. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Right, and there's the obvious, or the, I guess, the more surface level understanding of this, like, right, Guns N' Roses has a level of popularity and fame that is mythic, particularly in the late 80s and early 90s. And Guns N' Roses also has a moment that we might call the meteor, right? Grunge killed it all. And the fact that Axl and Kurt almost fought at a VMAs is really on the nose, but also, right? That's the image. That's the thing. Use Your Illusion comes out in 91, is a massive success, is also massively bloated. So Guns N' Roses, I think, are kind of their own meteor, because what's happening on Appetite for Destruction, as I was saying earlier, like the punkness of it all, and just the realness of it. Like, I think I've said before, I hate breaking out the authenticity thing, but like kind of what you were saying, how hair metal, right, is generally appearance. It's generally facade. It's put on, it's image, it's imagery rather. This was just Guns N' Roses, man. They're not faking it. Are they going to benefit from the marketing of it? Absolutely, but they're not faking it. And so I think that becomes kind of part and parcel with grunge in many ways. So like Guns N' Roses kind of setting up their own downfall and Use Your Illusion, when they're indulging proggier ambitions, right? It's kind of funny. Like they start more punk, they end up more symphonic. What killed prog? Punk did. So like they kind of do the inverse, and then grunge takes over. Like I just think it's really, it's been talked about a lot, but it's just really fun to think of that transition moment and Guns N' Roses as the torchbearer, really, that just dissolves, that they implode rather, as grunge takes off. Which I think, you know, are those bands gonna name Appetite for Destruction? Probably not, but I think you can hear it there. I think you can make a good argument that, especially that back half, like you were saying, like a lot of the seeds are here. So it's interesting in that way, just thinking about like the meteor that destroys them, which of course it's not a single event that wipes out all the dinosaurs. Like it's a escalating series of events, precipitating ones. So I think you see kind of Guns N' Roses, or Appetite for Destruction in particular, right? It brings in kind of fresh perspective. It brings in a kind of realness to hair metal, makes them this megafauna of popularity, of, you keep laughing at megafauna. Do you not like my biological precision?
I'm just sitting here thinking about which band is the giant ground sloth of hair metal. Like, and it's not other megafauna, it's just the giant ground sloth. And just thinking about that particular thing and nothing else, and it's just really getting my funny bone.
Quiet Riot.
Okay. Maybe this is the Decel instead is.
Well, you're going to be delighted when I tell you that I've come up with dinosaur comps for all the bands.
Outstanding.
So let's talk Guns N' Roses. I have them down at, okay, look, Velociraptor is probably right, but it was way too easy. So instead, I'm going to go the Allosaurus.
Okay.
Which, as, I don't know, I feel like our generation, we all had a dinosaur moment.
Oh, trust me, you were speaking... I
know I you, but I meant the listeners.
Yeah, let's get theropods on this.
So the Allosaurus, similar to a Tyrannosaurus Rex, our old friend, old short arms, but the Allosaurus is a bit smaller. It's a bit faster. It is more vicious, and I just assume that it had an inferiority complex. And to me, all of those things are Guns N' Roses' relationship to hair metal.
And I think very important is that the Allosaurus is what really should have been in Jurassic Park for those of us who are literalists about these mm-hmm. things, because it is a Jurassic mm-hmm. critter, and T-Rex is a Cretaceous critter. Yeah, I like that. There's like sort of a middle child aspect to this that's... Mm-hmm. It is sort of funny just sort of imagining Guns N' Roses in this. Again, it is sort of a weird spot for them. And they do sort of feel nimble is a good word for it. There is like a nimble quality to them, but also a sense that they are not, they exist at too awkward a time for them to ever truly be mm-hmm. the biggest bullies on the playground.
And I think too that, like, right, vicious and rumbling when they want to be, but they're, like you were saying, like, not plotting necessarily, or inherently, I suppose. Like, there's a bit more there. There's a nimbleness, there's a quickness, there's a way in which, again, they are just better adapted, but also kind of don't fit. The other bit I'm going to run through this is, right, these are all from 1987, and if we're thinking about the dinosaurs roaming, what are some of the lesser fauna in their, in their wake? So I'm going to just do brief kind of lists of albums that came out in the same month as each of these for 1987. So Appetite for Destruction comes out in July. What else comes out in July of 1987? I could put a lot of narrative to all of these, but I think I'm just going to mostly do the lists. I think it's actually fun to see what came out. So Echo and the Bunnymen, their self-titled album, which is a post-punk thing, essentially. Paid in Full by Eric B. and Rakim, which we're going to get to on this list at some point. I also don't think I ever mentioned this is number 57 on the spin list. Would I put it higher? Maybe. Just kind of because it's fun. Like, that means something to me, but I don't know. I don't get mad that it's here. I'm honestly glad it's on the list at all. I was worried, but yeah, 57 on the spin list. Do with that what you will. Anyway, back to July 1987. Faster Pussycat, their self-titled album, hair metal to the extreme. Dio's Dream Evil, which is a lesser Dio album, I think, but right, Dio's still hanging around. Once Bitten by Great White, also hair metal to the extreme. And Scum by Napalm Death. I think Napalm Death came up in that old metal death style. Right, this is sludge. This is like death metal adjacent. This is the burgeoning of the new sound there. So it's just, it's very interesting range, I think, in all of these months, but in July in particular, right? You have a foundational hip hop album, you have a foundational post punk band, you have hair metal stereotypes, and then you have this kind of burgeoning new metal sound. And Guns N' Roses just strides over all of it. But you can see kind of the seeds of its past and of its downfall in there. So I just think it's interesting to kind of go through the months in that way. Any thoughts on any of those?
The Eric B. and Rakim thing is a very interesting pairing with Appetite for Destruction. It is sort of funny that there is like a Dio album just sort of like pasted into this, like another one of those people who you just sort of know that like an entire generation of aspiring rock stars and crazy guitarists all just wanted to be, and just seeing him, yep, like age next to this group a little bit is that's a narrative in itself.
Yeah. So Paid in Full is in 5 episodes, I think. So we'll get to that one relatively soon. That'll be a fun one. But yeah, 87, surprisingly like deep year, which I didn't know until about yesterday, when I also realized there are a lot of albums we've already talked about that are also from 1987. Like, this is a sneaky important year, apparently.
Do you have some like on this on your mind?
So I'll be honest, I forgot to pull the sheet up. I have a couple offhand, but riff for like a few seconds and I'll pull up the list I wanted to cover, but just forgot to pull up at the beginning.
So a totally unrelated thing, but my brother's birthday was like a week and change ago, and I wished him happy birthday, and he said, "Thank you. Time is the predator, ... He was born in 1987. And I think it's very exciting that we are doing this episode about dinosaurs from 1987, because I'm sure he would just absolutely love that description, which I'm sure he's already struggling enough.
I was going to ask you which one, and then when you gave the response, I was like, happy late birthday, yeah, Mike. All right, so I pulled up the list I wanted. It's not anything like niche. It's just so it's a website called Digital Dream Door, which is a website that I found a long time ago and just have an odd fondness for. Like I like the lists that they're up to, and they have a ton of them. You might actually enjoy just digging around in here, Tim.
That sound you hear is me Googling them on my phone.
There you go. Yeah, there's just like it's a very old browser, and you can tell right away, but like they're just doing some yeoman's work over there. So anyway, they're top for 1987. Number one is The Joshua Tree by U2. Number two is Appetite for Destruction. Number three is Sign of the Times, Prince. So we've covered that one. Number four is Paid in Full. We will cover that one. Number five is Bad by Michael Jackson, which is going to come up for a later album as the same month. Number six is one of our subtitles, and I will save the suspense for a moment longer. Number seven, here you go, Tim, is Faith by George Michael. Or maybe there you go, Mike, more for you. Yep. Number eight, Document by REM. So again, like a burgeoning rock subgenre that's gonna kill number two on the list. Number nine, Kick in XS. Number 10, Criminal Minded, Boogie Down Productions. Now just kind of running through, actually we'll go to how far do I want, we'll go to 20 because it's fun, and we already knew this was going to be a long episode. Anyway, number 11, Sister by Sonic Youth. We've talked Sonic Youth. I think I have Sister in a later episode, so we might get to that one. Number 12 is Whitney by Whitney Houston. Number 13, Yo, Bum Rush the Show, Public Enemy. Another fun one to just have here amidst everything else. Number 14, this is topical now, Permanent Vacation by Aerosmith. Number 15, Tunnel of Love by Bruce Springsteen. Any Tunnel of Love pithy thoughts while we're here, or should I just
keep scrolling? This is a super interesting year, though.
That's what I'm saying. Number 16, one of my favorite Cure albums, Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me. And then right after this is Disintegration. Incredible moment for the Cure. Anyway, they're in a later episode too. I think I have Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me in one. We talked about the weird release history of Diesel and Dust by Midnight Oil. So they technically count here, but they also technically count for another year. Number 18, Strange Ways Here We Come, which I also have in a later episode. Number 19, Bring the Family, John Hiatt, because we needed something random in here. And number 20, this one makes me laugh, Introducing the Hardline According to Terrence Trent D'Arby by, you guessed it, Terrence Trent D'Arby. Any thoughts on the top 20 while I scroll again just to find some other standouts?
It's just, that's a super interesting year. I think the dinosaurs megafauna thing is entirely appropriate when you just sort of think about, like, again, even if it's not like the best album from these people, like just this idea that they're all still going. And of course, 1987 has always struck me as a particularly paltry year for American movies. And worldwide, it's not necessarily brilliant either. Like a lot of the best stuff from 1987 in movies is just like, who are your favorite European auteurs from a decade and more ago? Because they're still working. But like, it's kind of a dry period, but not so for the music half of this podcast.
No, like it would be fun to just go through this entire list of 100, but just in those top 20, like you see so many burgeoning things, like things that are about to become big, whether that's the individual bands or the subgenres that they're part of. And you get some of the dinosaurs across this thing too, right? There's a few different hair metal bands in here. Heart in their synthier days is on here. Great White is on here somewhere. Whitesnake is on here, right? There's a lot of these vestiges, but you see, especially near the top, like here's the stuff that's going to change it all, and Guns N' Roses is kind of there, and they're massive, but man, they're not going to last in the way that the other ones do. Just some other standouts because I like them. Tango and the Nights on here at 27. Good ass Fleetwood Mac album. Definitely going to be in an episode. Girls, Girls, Girls by Motley Crue. If you want your actual hair metal stereotype, is down here. Dokken is on here for reasons. Depeche Mode, Music for the Masses, right before they kind of take off too. So another one. Pleased to Meet Me by The Replacements is on here. Tim's favorite band.
Yeah, they sure are.
The Lion and the... Big Black is on here too. So in both like them and The Replacements, again, you have like how indie and how alt rock are gonna change pretty massively. Got an early Chili Peppers album on here, The Lion and the Cobra by Sinead O'Connor, which is a damn good album. Heavy D and the Boys are here. I just like Heavy D and the Boys. Anthrax is on here, more hair metal towards the end. Brian Adams making an appearance. Darklands by the Jesus and Mary Chain. We talked about them a little bit, not that album, but and at number 100, because they should be 100 on every list, is Yes with Big Generator, which is not an album that anyone remembers from Yes.
It's not a Yes album, I know.
No, but all love to Yes. So it's a weird list. It's an oddly rife year, and an oddly important year that apparently I have to do more with, because I didn't realize this until yesterday. Anyway, our replacement titles for When Dinosaurs Roamed. Well, one of them was number 6 on that list. I skipped it. It's Hysteria by Def Leppard. So excited. And the other one is also on this list. But it's further down. Clearly it's not in the top 20. It's at number 55, and it's Electric by The Cult. And we're going to start with The Cult, which comes out in April of 1987. And I suppose we can do this first. What else came out in April of 1987? I named a few of them. So White Snakes, self-titled, comes out. Tango in the Night comes out. Yo Bum Rush the Show. The Legacy by Testament. So again, we have right these metal subgenres as, you know, more influenced by Metallica and the like. Let Me Up, I've Had Enough by Tom Petty. Sort of a notorious transition period for him, and Let Me Up just sounds exhausted in many ways. And I think, honestly, that's a pretty compelling narrative, because right after this, you're going to get kind of the renaissance for Tom Petty, but this is still that like deep sigh moment. And it feels fitting that we have kind of the dinosaur thing for that. And Faith No More's Introduce Yourself comes out this month as well. This is before Mike Patton comes on, so they're not full Faith No More yet. But again, that history that, you know, a lot of 90s bands are going to pick up on, we see kind of starting here. So that's what's coming out around Electric, around The Cult. And The Cult themselves start out, Love is their first album, and they're more like The Cure on that. They're kind of a goth rock thing. It's a lot of synths. It's a lot of pageantry. It's a lot of swelling theatricality. She Sells Sanctuary is the big single from that album. Still holds up very well. But, you know, in that mid-80s moment, this is a band, you know, drawing from those electronic wells, those synth wells, those goth rock and maybe slightly post-punkish wells. But, you know, I think in that moment, they're as likely to open for The Cure as anything else. And they go through that for a bit. And then Electric is kind of this reinvention of their sound. So again, this comes out in 87, obviously. And the analogy here might be like, you know, Bob Dylan goes electric. Like, it's called Electric, so I don't want to be too on the nose, but like, right, this just, maybe the better analogy is anytime you see a band and it's like, we're going back to basics. So this album, it's just four guys. It's just, you know, guitar, bass, drums, vocals. It's them drawing from the blues, from, you can hear the Rolling Stones all over this thing. It's them kind of bringing back that dinosaur of classic rock. As I'm talking, Tim is looking at the floor, and I'm real curious, like, what he's doing.
Oh, yeah, no, the cat's here.
Oh, the cat's here.
Trust me, I am listening, but the longer I can keep this little monster at bay, the easier this podcast will go.
No, I was sure you were listening. It was just, I saw you kept staring at the floor, and it's like, well, he found something. So, again, like, not necessarily back to basics for the band itself, since they start in a different place, but back to basics in terms of what they imagine a rock band to be. So they move away from the synth led. They move away from the more symphonic, and they move to a more visceral thing. They move to a more blues based thing. And again, Stones are all over this thing. Singles like Wildflower and Little Devil have that kind of Rolling Stones swagger. You know, not literally at the same time, but close to the time when the Stones are going to Jumpin' Jack Flash. So like right there, reinventing themselves, and the Cult is just kind of bringing back this, or what we all identify now as kind of a base for pop rock, not pop hyphen rock, but rock acts that are pop. You know, the way that they incorporate the blues, the way that they have just sort of that strut, that swagger about them. Love Removal Machine, which I think is probably the biggest single from this album. I don't know if it's literally the Start Me Up riff, but it's really damn close. So it's them playing around explicitly with that, with, right, just ascribing themselves with this. But I think even at that point is kind of classic. You know, we're talking about all the ways that it was becoming new, becoming different, becoming diffuse. You know, they're 20 years past the, I mean, the Stones have been around for so long, but like 20 years past that kind of understanding of rock's first peak, maybe like that 60s moment, that British invasion, that Beatles and Stones moment. So, you know, we're pretty far on from that, and they're reclaiming it in certain ways, sometimes much more literally, like in Love Removal Machine, or sometimes just more in sound. It's not all Stones party here. Electric Queen sounds like AC/DC, honestly. It's very tight and coiled, and the riff just sort of pulses through the whole thing. It's circular in the ways that Angus does so well. Or a song like Bad Fun, just a heavy, loud song. It rumbles like a Deep Purple or like a Steppenwolf. You even have a Steppenwolf cover on this album. So there's just a way that the Cult starts as kind of a boundary pusher. Like in the mid 80s, in 84, 85, right? This sound that we, right, The Cure is the standard bearer for now, but like this is still kind of an emerging thing, and the Cult is right there with everybody. And then they decide, you know what, we're gonna look back at the dinosaurs for all of this and do that and become that tight blues rock band, become that, you know, I gotta add too, this is an album that is corny and horny as hell. King Contrary Man is, honestly, it's so close to a George Thorogood song, and I think we'd all do well to remember George Thorogood a little bit more, but it has that just like strutting riffage throughout, and Ian Astbury here is just kind of talking at us. It has that story element to it, that like the individual travails of the man, like it has that Thorogood spirit to it, but it's just sort of prowling in a way where Thorogood is just funny. Most of the time, like the song is kind of funny, but not in the same ways. Or you get a song like Peace Dog, which has lyrics, B-52, baby. I'm eliding a little bit here. Come drop your lovin' on me. Poetry. So I think for whatever lyrical, I don't know, progressiveness, maybe one saw in the Cult on earlier albums, I don't know that much is there, but it's certainly gone by the time of this. But I think it's, right, I think that's part of the argument too, that this is a band that identified, you know, we really want to be in touch with the bigness of that history. Like, this is who we are. and that was fun. Like, it's fun to think about dinosaurs. It's fun to think about them roaming. It's fun to think about their bigness, about their loudness, about their heaviness. And I think we have just kind of a literal example here of the Cult doing that on electric and doing it really well. Like, I really enjoy this album. The Cult, I honestly don't know how it started. I have a deep fondness for them. I couldn't tell you, like, I don't remember the first time I heard them or even the first song I heard. Like, I just remember kind of coming to having a weird love for them, and that has sustained. though I must admit it's probably just the 80s albums. Like, most of these bands, they kind of peter out after that, which is also sort of the point. But you have them at this interesting moment here of, like, this incredible timing, or bad timing perhaps, of at the beginning of their career, they're in sort of the vanguard of a thing, decide, no, we need to go back to the real dinosaurs. And they choose to do that right before it's all about to go to hell. So, you know, I think Electric is an album that maintains some of the, like, 80s goth art stuff that they're doing that gets fit into hair metal, I think mostly unfairly, but right, any album doing hard rock in this moment is going to be put into hair metal, at least by somebody. But I think it's bringing the dinosaurs back to this moment in the 80s when it was really passe. When, you know, as I've shown in just a couple of months and by reading through that list in general, like, right, there's a lot of emerging stuff here. There's a lot of dying stuff. It's just very diffuse in general. And I think we have the Cult here setting themselves up as, all right, we'll be the dinosaur, whether that's risky or passe or not. I'll give you my dinosaur comp in a moment, but any thoughts on Electric or the Cult, Tim? I'm going to guess this. You said you listened to two. I'm going to guess not this one.
Yeah, I ran out of time before I could get to this one. If the UNC Duke game had been a little bit worse, then I probably would have found a way to figure that out. But I'm very interested in any band that just sort of, like, because this idea of, like, let's go back to the garage is already kind of a stereotype in itself, right? Like, this idea of we're doing too many other things. We have too many, like, distractions going on from our music. Let's just take this back to the extreme basics of four dudes, those instruments, you know, and sort of work on it from there. Uh-oh. About to find out our first test of this microphone with the cat.
Speaking of dinosaurs.
Oh, I am worried about this mini fauna that is now on the desk. So that's definitely something that interests me about this group, and just sort of hearing the sheer number of things that go into becoming kind of like this sort of minimalized, I mean, minimal is not often a term one hears with hard rock, but like this sort of like more austere, more purposefully austere version of it compared to the sort of goth rock they'd done before, and hearing that turn into AC/DC or George Thorogood, depending on the song, is a pretty wild set of options that they could go for. But I'm very curious to hear which dinosaur this is.
I like this one. I think this one's good. I was just gonna say real quick though, you know, for anyone listening, if you want a less 80s comp, though it's not that much less 80s, but the Cult on Electric, anyway, I don't think it's that far removed from like what the Black Crowes would start doing, you know, 1990 and onward. It has some of that vibe to it as well. So if, you know, if that's a band you enjoy, I think this is just a really fun, accessible album. I think that's true of all three of these, but this one especially is like, I don't know, it has less baggage, perhaps. So good times. The Dinosaur. Do you want to take any guesses? You want to draw on your deep well of dinosaur knowledge?
I was sitting here trying to think of a dinosaur that's like a retro dinosaur, and I'm like, what on earth is a retro dinosaur?
I will tell all the listeners this is risky for me to do because Tim has more knowledge of dinosaurs than I do. So I may get proven wrong in this, but I'm curious.
I honestly have no idea. I'm willing to hear just about anything at this point, and we'll figure it out.
All right. So I'm going to Potosaurus.
Okay. Tell me about it.
Because so the Apatosaurus, famously massive tree trunk legs, that, you know, they're not rearing up in any way. And this album literally and kind of spiritually is four to the floor. Like, it's going back to that, again, that kind of minimal guttural sound. I didn't say all these reasons were clever. And I think the Apatosaurus too, because of its debated identity. I think you have different versions of the cult, and it's interesting which one someone gravitates towards. And I don't think they're ever really able to shake either. I don't think on this album anybody forgets that, like, this, or at the moment anyway, that, like, this is the band that did She Sells Sanctuary. So, and the Apatosaurus, of course, once, forever, I don't know, depending on your stance, being the Brontosaurus. So it's mostly for that reason of debated identity and how both kind of live on, whether they are supposed to or not. So I think no matter what the cult does, especially in 1987, like, this is a band kind of different worlds.
So do you feel like this is, like, the truest identity? Like, because Brontosaurus is, like, even in the 90s when we were, you know, getting into these ourselves, we knew that that was not the right name for it. Like, do you feel like this is a more accurate representation of, like, what the band wants to be, or at its best, this is what it is? Or
I think this is what the band wants to be. I think this is the identity they want for themselves. I don't think they're upset necessarily with, like, their Brontosaurus age, so to speak. But they, right, in 87, there's definitely a conscious move away from it. Like, they really wanted to do this. They were unhappy with the second album in particular, I think. So I think this is the band they want to be. If you go and just listen to their greatest hits, which is a good compilation, one of these Decils has to be best greatest hits albums, or, like, bands that would make for the best, like, newer bands that would make for great, greatest hits albums. Anyway, I think you're going to get more that sounds closer to stuff on Electric than you would on, say, Love. But as they go on in their career, you're going to hear a bit of both. But I think this is who they want to be. Which one is best? Overall, I think this version. But I'm also, I mean, I'm quite fond of the goth rock version. Again, Sanctuary is just a massive song. Fire Woman is actually their favorite of mine. And that's one that kind of bridges the two. But I think this is definitely what they want to be. And I think, to me, this is probably the better version of the band as a whole, I guess. The single's debatable, but I think Electric is just a better listen than something like Love in its entirety, that is.
Okay. All right. That was an interesting answer. I was not prepared for the mislabeled dinosaur, but I like that.
I tried to make these fun and clever, but we'll see how well I do with the last one, which I'm not as sure about. But can we say I'm 2 for 2 so far?
Yeah, I like both of these.
Okay,
so far.
Okay, excellent. Moving on to our second replacement album, which I'm about to do my level best to not talk about for an hour. It's Def Leppard's Hysteria. Comes out in August of 1987. What else comes out in August of 1987, you ask? I'm glad you did. Darklands by the Jesus and Mary Chain. Mentioned that one earlier. Bad by Michael Jackson. Also mentioned earlier. Permanent Vacation, Aerosmith. Substance 1987 by New Order. And Move Something by Two Live Crew.
The New Order... Two Live Crew connection.
I think this month is a bit top heavy, but it gets interesting at the end there. But again, I think you have a big range of stuff happening here. Like, Jesus and Mary Chain and New Order are connected to classic rock, to dinosaur rock in certain ways, of course. But really, it's only Aerosmith that, like, is really holding the torch here, besides Def Leppard. And yeah, Two Live Crew just sort of in their own world, about to get banned everywhere. But yeah, anything stand out on that besides the randomness of the end?
No, it is pretty random. And just the number of groups that we've kind of already worked with too, just sort of hearing that, it does feel like sort of a come down from July though, on the whole.
I think it is. I think, well, again, I think it's very top heavy when you have the massive success of Bad and of Hysteria. Like, that's going to carry a lot.
Hysteria is doing a lot of work here. Yeah.
Hysteria has sold over 20 million at this point, I think. Bad, it's Michael Jackson. God knows how much it sold. Like, again, in terms, I mean, Permanent Vacation is fairly successful. And then you have, like, scene favorites in here, of course, but I think, yeah, it's not as deep a month, but in terms of just like the two albums on top selling, whew. So let's run it this way. So I'm behave a bit better here. Thoughts on Hysteria, Tim? Where do you want to go with Def Leppard?
So this is, I think the stereotype is probably a little bit less pronounced for Def Leppard than it is for Guns N' Roses. But I would just sort of like listening to the album on the whole, and I'd never listened to this one all the way through. Like, I had heard most of it one way or another, but like had never just gone straight through. Man, like, The Love Bites, Pour Some Sugar on Me, Armageddon It stretch is just like unbelievable. That's just an absolutely crazy stretch. I love that everything these people do is like 5.5 minute power ballad or bust. It like the ambition shines through every single time. I don't know, like it just sort of seemed like this is a megafauna album, which is a new term that no one has ever said before. But like this is the kind of album that you would say this is bigger than life. It is like that rare crossover success where everyone wants to listen to it, and obviously the musicianship on this I just thought was crazy, like absolutely crazy stuff.
I think I'm so glad you liked at least part of this, because I was going to get real chippy, which is just kind of part of my brand. Not anything, not anything personal. I think we know from a certain decile that I'm willing to go to long lengths, great lengths, to defend Def Leppard. Great lengths. Great lengths. I think Pyromania is the best Def Leppard album, and most people who care about 80s metal, I think, probably agree with that. But as you were saying, Tim, Hysteria, it's all here in its glorious bigness. And if the cult is trying to be a dinosaur of old, trying to, you know, have fun in that identity in that realm, Def Leppard just wanted to be the biggest band, man. And God damn, they came as I don't know if they made it, but they came really close, if not. And like, it's just all intentional. They wanted to be the most mega of megafauna out there. And it's always happy hour somewhere, and Pour Some Sugar on Me is always playing in a strip club somewhere. And that is a level of, what's the word I want here? What is the word?
Pervasiveness?
Yeah, sure. We'll go with that. That's not quite what I wanted, but that works. A level of pervasiveness that not a lot of people, not a lot of bands can have or make or will ever achieve. All right. A bit on Hysteria, because I'd be remiss if I didn't. This is a band also with sort of a plagued split identity. Obviously, they are of the hair metal crew, and they start a bit before that really takes off. Like Pyromania and High and Dry are certainly related, but they're just kind of different beasts. And Hysteria is kind of a real doubling, if not tripling or quadrupling down on the, like, we are pop and God damn it, we know how to write songs. And Phil Collin, which I always think is
very,
funny.
Very confusing.
Yeah, Phil Collin, one of the guitarists. I don't know when this quote happened. I didn't write it down, but you know, they were asking him about right how the band's always called metal. And I think, right, they have a relationship to that. I think the ways that they're bending it is really interesting, but they're not metal as we classically think of it. But they're coming from that scene in various ways. But Phil Collin says, we're about as close to metal as we are to Madonna. And I don't know quite how he wanted us to envision that, but I try to think, I think of it as they're pretty close to both, which is really the innovation of the band. Like, that's why Def Leppard is so good and so fun and so honestly unique. I think this is a band that has come to stand in for hair metal in many ways, or at least a version of it. Maybe the earlier, slightly more tame version of it, though certainly this is a band with their trials and tribulations. And of course, with the British version of it, right? They're part of the new wave of British heavy metal in the very late 70s to early 80s. But this is a band that wanted to be... Right, they love their guitars, they love their rock, they love their metal, but they want to be pop and they want to be huge. And the production on this album is absolutely incredible. Mutt Lange made sure that this band sounds as huge as possible, and that this is an album made for stadiums, made for arenas. And you know, I don't think there are a lot of instances where a band decides, hey, we want to be that big arena act, like has that ambition and actually makes it work so well like this one. And the story is that Thriller was kind of a motivating thing, that the band and Lang wanted an album that was so full of singles that it becomes pervasive in the ways that it is. Women, Rocket, Animal, Love Bites, Pour Some Sugar on Me, Armageddon It, Hysteria, the title track, right? That's... what was that, 6 or 7 just major singles for the band. Certainly some are bigger than others, but like, those are all ones you can go hear on the radio. Those are ones that are on the greatest hits. Those are ones that you're going to hear live. And the B material, as it were, on here is still damn good, but like, this is just an album chocked full of singles. And the biggest one of all was a throwaway at the end of the recording sessions. And I think was actually like the 5th or 6th released single. I don't remember that for sure, but I'm pretty sure that's true. That Pour Some Sugar at Me was kind of an afterthought for the band and became just absolutely massive.
That's sort of like the Sweet Child of Mine riff, you know, just sort mm-hmm. of like, we have mm-hmm. this and it's like, oh, maybe this will be interesting.
Yeah. As these things happen, one can't predict it. The album opens with Women, which is a riff shot directly from space. And it's already way too much, but man, the harmonies, it's all so good. It sounds so clean. It sounds so epic. It sounds so big. It sounds so megaphonic. Like this is marveling at the dinosaur in Jurassic Park. Just the bigness, the kind of sublimeness of it all, that like it's, you watch it and you kind of marvel at the sound of it all. And like that it actually happened is, you know, not scary necessarily, but just like, it's a moment. It's a real moment. It's a real time to listen to this thing. And especially, and I actually think this goes to the dinosaur comp a little bit. So this is the album after Rick Allen, the drummer, was in a car crash and lost his arm. So it's amazingly a 4-year gap between this and Pyromania, only 4 years. But he learns to play with one arm. His drum set is rigged so that he plays with one arm, partially with his other foot, and then the bass drum with his other, like he's playing more with his feet, which is incredible, really. I still like don't know all that goes into that, but, and he's still going, like it's really amazing. But I think because of that, this album has a lot more stomp to it, and understandably so. Like, how much could you play with one arm and your feet? But that really lends, I think, to A, the bigness of it, the arena of it, but also lends to kind of the dinosaur vibe of it, that these are songs that generally, as you were saying, Tim, like it's 5.5 minutes, ballad or bust, or just like massive, you know, massive arena jam or bust. But it has that, again, that elephantine stomp to it, partially out of necessity, but that really works for the identity of the thing. And the guitars are generally kind of lurking behind that, shooting through it, floating above it. Like, again, the harmonies throughout this are just absolutely awe-inspiring. There's so many hooks on this album. And I think I describe it as this, and I will stand by it. I'm going to see if you giggle or not. I think this is the whole of hair metal, the whole of its ambitions without the pretentiousness. I don't think this is a melodramatic album. I think it's a bombastic album, but I don't think it's pretentious. I think it's ambitious, but I think like this is just dudes making music they love, and that actually like they want to be the biggest thing, but like they're doing something. It's not a put on. Like this is the music that they are uniquely adapted to do. You were going to say?
No, I was just going to say for our listeners that there was no giggle, not even a smirk at that. I think that's an extremely apt way to put it.
I got a little head nod. I was happy with that. So moving on. Rocket, another standout, I think, the riffs on that like actually sparkle. Like you can hear a twinkle, you can hear a sparkle, and just how that's produced, how clean it all sounds. And another just huge stomp, the bass drum in this thing is way turned up, and it really works. And I want to, right to the point where if you just had the rhythms, these songs maybe plod a little, but the guitars and the vocals are so acrobatic, that it really works. And it's kind of an inverse of, I don't know, maybe what happens after this, where it's sort of lurching or crunchy guitars, but maybe there's some swing in the rhythms. There's kind of an inverse of that. It's not novel, I'm not saying that, but like it stands out as interesting in the moment. And in terms of the dinosaurs that they're bringing on, I think glam metal. This is a band absolutely influenced by that. They've done covers of T-Rex songs. I think you can hear some Sweet in here. You know, New York Dolls is in here to some degree, but like T-Rex, I think, is the big kind of guiding star. And it has similar production qualities to like Tango in the Night, which again comes out in this year as well. So it's their pop ambitions, their glam ambitions, and their just huge rock guitar metal ambitions, all of it coming perfectly together. Which is both incredible and also emblematic of a doomed moment. Like this is not the last big album for that movement, that scene, that subgenre, that whatever, but it's a real climax. And you're just not going to get another Hysteria. And I think, you know, the dinosaur that it wanted to be, it achieved that to the point too that it's extinct. We're not going to get another one like this, which is sad, but I think we can just look back at it and kind of marvel. I'll get into the dinosaur comp in a second, but anything on this one, Tim?
I was just trying to, I don't know. I don't know that I have a lot to add about this other than it just... I did have the thought while listening to this, and it's almost like a YouTube comment section thought, and I was ashamed of it, but just like they really don't make stuff like this anymore. And like, they really just like, don't have albums like this anymore. And it's a shame that there aren't. And I think, again, part of the calculus with that line of thought has to be, one does not simply make an album like this. Like, part of the reason that this feels so special is because it really does require so many things to go right. And whether it's that mindset of we're just gonna make the entire airplane out of the black box and just make hits for every single track and see how it goes, like you can try to do that, and whether or not that's actually effective is something. If you're not Def Leppard or Michael Jackson, I guess it's kind of hard to pull that off.
This is honestly a perfect struck. I mean, I kind of talked about imagining the streaming album before the streaming album. This is like a beautiful example 30 years before that really mattered. I love this band. I think this album is just incredible for what it is, and we're not going to see another one. And maybe that's good to you. I don't know that we need more. I'm just glad that we have this. So our dinosaur comp, I think I'm pronouncing this correctly, but correct me or forgive me if not. Quetzalcoatlus.
Oh my gosh, that was the first thing I had in mind. Go ahead.
I should have asked you for your guess. I forgot to.
I have a not a counter to this, but it's a similar idea. But go ahead.
So I had pterodactyl for a minute, but again, that seemed too easy. Not that I'm picking like truly random dinosaurs here. But well, we'll start there. Part of it is not actually a dinosaur. Mm-hmm. Def Leppard, not really a dinosaur. A flying lizard, if you will. But more to the point, Quetzalcoatlus described as there was a lot of debate over their, like, what they ate and how they came about it. I looked into this, actually. It was interesting. The most recent studies suggest that they were terrestrial stalkers. And I like that in the sense of this is a band that will pull equally from Madonna as they will from metal, from T-Rex as they will from Fleetwood Mac. Just not in a malicious way, but they will just stalk all of these different styles and modes and pull from whatever they want, whatever they need to, whatever speaks to them to achieve an album this big. The Quetzalcoatlus is the biggest of the flying lizards, which I relate to. Look, all these 80s bands tour together now, and whenever Def Leppard's on the bill, they're headlining. I think unless they toured with Guns N' Roses, that would basically be the case. So I think this is still the biggest of the dinosaurs, or the biggest of their realm, at least. Again, not a dinosaur. I think that's important. And the last point I have here is that this was another fun moment in my studies to their evolution. Their limb proportions are uniquely suited to basically terrestrial life. They could walk around in different ways. They were more nimble. And I think that speaks to, I don't think this is a band that, right, jack of all trades, master of none. I think in similar ways to how I was talking about the stalking, just this is a uniquely suited band to make an album like this, to make something this huge, to have a moment like this, to make something this mega. They could exist in so many different worlds and not be dragged down by that, basically, that they are just uniquely adapted in a way that other bands were not to do this kind of thing. So, Quetzalcoatlus.
I like that. I sort of went in a similar direction with what was in my head, and I went Spinosaurus, which is our largest, like carnivore theropod living on land. And what I like about it is this idea of not being pretentious. Like, the thing about it that's so interesting that everybody likes is that it's got like the big sail on the back. But obviously it has the sail for a reason. It's not something that just exists for itself. So like, whether it was to show off and like intimidate other critters or display for a mate, or if it was like a way to regulate its body temperature and body heat, like, it was evolved to have the giant sail that is making it special. And I think we have a similar idea here, the adaptability, but also the hugeness, the blots out the sun kind of vibe.
Yeah. I thought of the Spinosaurus for a minute. I decided I wanted a flying reptile because again, we're as much metal as Madonna. Like, it kind of exists between two worlds, between two two things. So it's right, it's the bird and the reptile of it all. It's the dinosaur of it all. Like, it's all of that stuff together, adapted in very particular ways. So yeah, I think we're onto similar things here. Good. I'm glad I did well with the dinosaurs. That was the that was the most stress for this episode. Anything else on any of these, Tim? You ready for spiel?
Yeah, let's go for it.
All right. This is long, but I don't think it's too bad, at least.
It's shorter than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, we did okay. We did okay. Number 57 on the spin list, Appetite for Destruction by Guns N' Roses, their 1987 full album debut, at least. Look, it's massive. It has singles that will live long past us. It's an album of mythic proportions, and for that reason, I wanted to think about when dinosaurs roamed. We're not going to get another Guns N' Roses. We're not going to get another album or moment like this. It was a megafauna of its time. It had a level of popularity and fame that is really unique. And I think the meteor that kills it is the meteor that they themselves set up to some degree. So looking at the ways that two other albums are kind of bringing back dinosaurs of their time, but also setting themselves up as the megafauna of the moment. Now, granted, they're all in 1987, so they're all operating, you know, within months of each other. First option for Tim is Electric by the Cult. They move away from being a goth rock, a more arty band, to, you know, kind of back to basics, a back to the garage, a four to the floor blues, just kind of like a swing mentality. These are shorter, really compulsive songs, really guttural in all the best ways. This is an album that you could tie to the Rolling Stones, to AC/DC, to Deep Purple, to Steppenwolf, to George Thorogood, all in equal proportions. Like, they are bringing back the dinosaurs of their childhood, of their time here, and just kind of reveling in how cool that is to feel like one. We all have that moment when we're children where it's like, man, what would it be like to be around the dinosaurs or to like see them? A, terrifying, but B, like, it'd just be super cool. And I think the Cult is doing that on Electric. Interestingly, because they were at the vanguard of something, went back to this right before it's about to be killed. So like they're setting themselves up in the fun of that world and having a great time, being the thing that they want to be. But it's doomed. Similarly, doomed is the moment after Def Leppard's Hysteria, our second choice for Tim here. This thing's just big. It's massive. It's stadium rock excellence. It is beautifully produced. It's gorgeous harmonies throughout. There's the rhythms of this, the bass drum in particular, is all turned up. Like, there's just that moving stomp or thump to it. Again, part of that is from, you know, the tragedy of Rick Allen losing an arm. But I think that really works in the favor for just the bigness of this thing. And we talked about, right, the ways that Def Leppard is between a lot of different styles, a lot of different reference points, that they're as much metal as Madonna. And that becomes the thing. Okay, let's build the boat out of, we have this rock basis, we have these pop ambitions, we have this incredible technical ability to make something this big, something this popular, something this enduring. Let's be the massive dinosaur of the moment. And they did it with Hysteria. They achieved it, and with aplomb. And you know, talked a little bit about the ways that they're bringing kind of glam back for a moment, that like they're working that into their style, kind of a dinosaur of their childhood. But really, this right with Hysteria, they set out, let's be the biggest, let's be the greatest, let's be the baddest. And they did it. And that's why Hysteria is here. So, Tim, I turn it over to you. The Cult or Def Leppard? Or should I say Apatosaurus or Quetzalcoatlus? Yeah.
I think this one was fairly easy for me, not through any disrespect for the Cult or for your average sauropod, but there's something about how giant everything with Hysteria is that sort of pushes it over for me. So whether it's because it has that sort of awe-inspiring reputation, or it's the awe-inspiring band, or it's the awe-inspiring like single, like Pour Some Sugar on Me is just like, it is forever, it is going to last forever. I just sort of have a hard time hearing like, and you didn't have to say much to like to convince me of that for this one, but I think like you certainly said enough to push it over the edge here, even though the idea of sort of like playing that sort of retro who would we like to be more like thing is really interesting for the Cult. I just feel like there might be a right answer here, so I'm just going to go with the right answer.
I think we all know and assume there's no way am I sad about Def Leppard winning. Again, I do genuinely really like The Cult, and I think Electric's a really good album. It's like 35-40 minutes, so it's a pretty quick, just good time. So I encourage everyone to listen to it, but I think I had a good argument for it. But yeah, there's just a like, right, Hysteria is the literal dinosaur. And you may think, and you're probably right, that Pour Some Sugar on Me is overplayed, but I have a hard time ever like being sick of that song when it comes on. May not be one that I turn on purposefully all the time because it just is pervasive in the rest of my life. And that may be the same for you, but like that thing still works, that this whole thing still works. There's just not going to be another. And so, right, that makes perfect sense to me as, you know, this is the dinosaur. There's not going to be another Appetite for Destruction. There's not going to be another Hysteria. So congrats to Def Leppard. I'm very glad to see them go through, and really, really worried about what I do with them on the ranking of the winners. Yeah, that's going to be dangerous. Shame on Spin for not having Hysteria up here, but I am righting wrongs. And anything else on any of this, Tim?
No, we are about justice for the dinosaurs. Don't bring them back. They belong where they are, but yep. honor them for existing.
We don't need them back, but we can appreciate the majesty of them. And it can stay safely in the past. I think that's the best takeaway here. This was honestly like I enjoy listening to and you know, just kind of thinking through the albums every week. But this was honestly one of the most just fun listening sessions. Like three just good times of albums. So there are much, much worse ways to spend an afternoon if you're hearing this and not totally in tune with your 80s rock. Thank you for listening. If you want to... Oh, I guess I should do the recap. So number 57 on the spin list was Appetite for Destruction by Guns N' Roses. And in the theme of When Dinosaurs Roamed, I gave Tim the choices of Electric by The Cult and Hysteria by Def Leppard, and... justifiably so, Hysteria makes its way through to torture me when I rank other things. Thank you for listening. Now, if you want to see more about us, who we are, what we do, how this thing started, if you want to see either of our blogs, if you want to see his Letterboxd or my if you want to see my playlists, please, or back episodes of the podcast. We have, again, a bunch at this point. We referenced several during this. So if you want to see what we were talking about, please go to our website, subtitlespodcast.com. And please also stay tuned for part 2 of this episode, where Tim will be talking about a dinosaur of the movie industry.